can hear my neighbor crying. I can't breathe. Now I'm in the struggle and I can't leave. Calling out the violence of the racist police. We ain't gonna stop till people are free. We ain't gonna stop till people are free.
All right. Welcome to the very first episode of the Ferguson Response Network podcast. I am your host at Leslie Mack, and I'm glad that you're joining us for our inaugural podcast. I started the Ferguson Response Tumblr kind of as a way of providing a single space for nationwide actions supporting Ferguson, and decided to expand a little bit and start this podcast as a way to provide a weekly place for us to discuss how we go about doing this work and giving some additional updates, resources, and tools to those of us that are working towards creating lasting social change through sustained civil disobedience and civic action. I am joined today by three wonderful people. First, we have Ebony Washington, who's a writer, software engineer, and activist from the Coalition Against Police Violence, CAPV. She's a proud graduate of Tuskegee University and pursued her master's at DePaul University. She's married and the proud mother of a three-year-old. Hey, Ebony, how are you?
Great. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. We also have Ivy Whisper, who's a mother of two and psychotherapist and activist. Specifically, she's interested in self-care for all witnessing and in dismantling racial bias as a system. Hey, Ivy.
Hey.
Thanks for being here. And finally, we have Ricky Hines, who's a Los Angeles native, a U.S. Navy veteran, avid Googler, blogger, of course, founder of the Americans United Again movement. He hosts his own podcast, the Americans United Again podcast, and also is co-host with Sherelle of the AUA Hope podcast. Hey, Ricky, what's going on?
Hey, I'm doing well. I must say thank you for allowing me to come on the inaugural episode of this podcast, and I feel honored. Thank you.
Oh, thanks to all three of you for being here. I kind of had this idea for doing the podcast. Obviously, I host another one with my husband, the interracial John. But I was just thinking and connecting with so many people doing work in the movement, that there isn't a place where we can kind of come together all the time and just hear about what's going on and provide some therapy a little bit on the airwaves for the work that's going on. It's so specific. It's so unique. It's something that's in our lifetime never been seen and kind of warranted some representation in the podcast airwaves. So here we are, and hopefully people will like it. Ebony, what brought you into kind of the movement, generally speaking? I know that you're a big part of CAPV. So tell me a little about that and kind of how you got started working on all this stuff.
Sure. So first I'll tell you about CAPV, and I'll let you know how I, as an individual, was moved to action, moved to physical action. Coalition Against Police Violence is a multicultural, intergenerational, non-denominational alliance of not just people, but also groups. And we have one common goal. We're all against police aggression. And our goal is really to take police violence. What we do is work on policy, work on economics via blackouts and boycotts, and we also do social activism. So I started that coalition to really bring together individuals and groups, right? We all need this commonplace. As individuals and as, you know, groups, we're all doing something about police violence, but we don't know what the other groups and what the other people are doing. So I wanted to create a space, create an organization where we can trade information, trade lessons learned, and support each other in our individual ventures. So as an individual, I've always been an activist, right? I'm always that one lady who's calling, you know, the local government, like, there's garbage here and it hasn't been picked up. What's the problem? That's against policy. But I think what really moved me to getting out at the street level, at the, you know, the physical activism level, is just the amount of, you know, horror, which it is, of dead black bodies across this country. Mm-hmm. And I have a young brother. My brother could easily be a victim. There's nothing about him that excludes him from this horror. So, you know, I take it personally. I do it for him. I do it for you know, me. You know, black yeah. women have died too.
Yep.
So I felt moved to do that.
Excellent. Thank you so much for sharing that. I know so many of us, I mean, we can't help but take it personally. It's interesting. You know, my husband is white, and it's something that we have had to kind of come to terms with as we both work in this, in the movement, is that we can't really, understand each other's positions 100%. You know, we're at actions and he may not feel them the same way that I do. It just is a fact of what's going on in the world. So I do appreciate that. Ivy, I'll come to you next, and kind of, I know you've been doing a lot of stuff, especially in the self-care area of things, and also in other areas of the movement. So talk to me a little about how you got involved and what you've been doing.
Sure. So I'm here, you know, I come from two places, I think. And, you know, one of those is, you know, being a white person and working towards how do we own our stuff, right? How do we own our responsibility, our history? How do we own what we need to do to help, you know, dismantle the system? Or how do we dismantle the system from within? So there's all those questions as a white person. And I've actually talked with Drew a few times about, okay, what do we need to do? Where are we? Mm. And I agree that conversation is different. It's a different conversation than the one that people of color are having, specifically black people. And I think that conversation between white people really needs to happen. Mm. So that's one place that I come from, right? And then the other place is that I'm a therapist, and I'm also somebody who has personally suffered depression and trauma. So I know those two, you know, and I know mm-hmm. mental health being a therapist. So I look at, you know, things like a young man's body being out in the street for 4 hours, and I go, that's going to cause vicarious trauma, right? Mm-hmm. Or you know, any of these really heavy topics that we're trying to get people to look at, we also need to take care of the people looking at them, mm-hmm. you know, and we need to take care of the people who are doing the hard work to get this seen and get this, you know, acknowledged, so that they can keep fighting. Because if you do this day in and day out, you're going to burn out unless you take care of yourself.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the topics that in the segments we're going to talk about a little later for sure, because I know it's something that almost every conference call that I've been on at least the past 3 weeks, and I've been on some national calls, I've been on some local calls, I've been in several meetings, and all of them have brought this this subject of self-care within the movement to the fore, and it being really concerning and something we all need to address, because this is going to be needs to be a sustained effort, and part of that sustaining has to be the self-care angle of it as well. Otherwise, it won't be sustainable. So Ricky, I guess I'll bring you into the fold and kind of get your thoughts a little bit about the movement, kind of how, I know AUA, you guys have been doing a lot of work on this, and you started it earlier this year, correct?
Yeah. April 4th.
April. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's about time. Mm. And I say that not as a judgment, mm-hmm. But I say that as a sign of relief, because
yeah.
this is something that, from my own personal experience and just looking at, like I said, I'm an avid Googler. So anytime I have questions, like the most random thing pops in my head and I go find it. And so I've had the opportunity of looking at a lot of data and a lot of statistics. And this is well overdue. And what that has shown me essentially is that the generation, I guess Gen X would be the best description, is largely let millennials and most of the generations going forward down as a whole. And so millennials have suffered from a lot of just hopelessness and apathy because they don't see it, or it's a matter of just trying to personally survive instead of making sure that the system works so that you do survive.
Right.
And I'm really grateful to see it happening. I'm grateful to be able to play whatever part that I play in it. That's really all I can say.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, so I've been working on issues related to mass incarceration here in New Jersey for about 2.5 years. I've been working mostly on the legislative side of things for the most part, on a couple of big initiatives here. We've had some bail reform bills that went through. We're working on parole issues now, and we had some ban the box initiatives as well. So I actually got started as a result of seeing the movie Fruitvale Station about Oscar Grant in Oakland. And I don't know what happened, but after I saw that movie, I saw it in the theater, it broke me. And I was like, okay, I can't not do something at this point. And so I kind of got involved then and was really a little bit depressed because I felt like it was such an insurmountable mountain that needed to be climbed. And then I read the new Jim Crow and started really looking at the systemic nature of these issues, and thought at least legislatively, locally, I could make some changes that would make a difference. And this movement has been, kind of a breath of fresh air for me. You know, Ricky, when you say it's about time, that's how I feel too, that okay, I feel like I can take a breath because I can be like, okay, we're talking about these things. It's something that I can have a conversation with people about and finally get to the heart of these issues, because I don't even think they were talked about in the previous civil rights movement, because there was so many non-systemic things, but overt things to fight, that the larger conversation about our history that has played into where we are today never even came to the table. And so it's going to be important. And I know this is something that, because millennials are driving this movement, that they have been so vocal about not shorting, not being short-sighted, having a really long vision for really addressing this at the systemic level. And I'm really excited by that. And I know that it's going to be a long haul and it's going to be a lot of work, but I'm hopeful that, we can get it done. So I'll go through really quick, just a quick recap of this past week and actions that were happening nationwide. Last week actually was a very active week. We had last week, on the 10th, we had 22 actions nationwide, 12 on the 11th, 16 on the 12th, and then on the 13th was the large call for the Day of Resistance, and we had over 70 cities that went and answered that call to action on Saturday. Huge actions all over the country, nationwide. Obviously, the big two were in D.C., which was called by Al Sharpton's NAN group, and in New York City, which was, I don't even know what to say about the images that were coming out of there. And then I know that on the West Coast, I think LA was really big as well from the photos that I saw. Did any of you guys get to participate at all on Saturday in anything locally?
Yeah.
No. And I'll explain why. I don't deal well around being told what to do when I shouldn't be told what to do. And so the odds are I probably would be in jail, and I didn't think that would be the most effective way to combat this, because I'd be in jail for something serious.
Mm-hmm. But you were in the service.
Yeah, but there's still a general expectation that what you're being told is fair.
Oh,
and
I
got true.
You. Okay,
and is right.
Gotcha.
Whereas, I'm out protesting against the practices that are being exercised on me right then and there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it so is definitely different.
I don't deal well with stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I'm just being quite honest.
No, I mean, it's definitely, I always say this, like, not everybody is meant to have boots on the ground in this fight, because it's not for everybody. And I know for me, like, I have to be very conscious of when I do it, but I do, for me, it's been important to get to do it when I can, because at least locally here in Philadelphia, it's given me a really good kind of grounding moment with the people that I'm working with on a regular basis. And also, as I'm providing tools and resources for the movement, it's really great for me to have that experience of what I saw that could have been useful there, what I saw that people might be needing. And so that's been something that's been important to me. But it's tough. I mean, it's definitely, for me, emotionally draining and also physically, because I'm not this youngest chicken out here. So it's definitely, it takes a toll, but it's definitely, you know, I have to kind of pick and choose. Ebony, I know you said you were in D.C., right? So did you get to go to the big march there?
Yes, I did. It was just a great, that whole day across the country was just a show of unity, and it was beautiful. Mm-hmm. Here in D.C., there was the National Action Network march that happened here. It was an interesting day on that march, and I'll be quick about it because I'm sure you've read some of the things that happened that day.
No, don't be quick, because I want to get you know, the flavor of it from somebody that was there. So definitely don't be quick.
So I was there. I was there as in right next to the stage where the family and you know, all of the VIP sat. Mm. And what I saw almost immediately was this conflicting ideologies, right? Mm. You had the youth who were there from Ferguson, the family of the victim, you know, DeRay and Netta and some of those other activists were there who believe that, and rightfully so, believe their voices should have been elevated, because they are. They, along with everyone else who has boots on the ground, keep this movement moving. Mm-hmm. But they weren't on the dais. Mm. They weren't, you know, speaking. So things escalated, let's just say that way. once we got to the point where everyone marched down Pennsylvania Avenue and all of the speakers were speaking, you know, some of the local activists here in D.C. and the Ferguson activists made themselves known on the stage. So there's footage out there of people taking the mic, like literally out of the speaker's hand and giving it to those Ferguson activists. And I thought it was a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. As
you know, some people had some feedback about how it should have happened, but if you're not given a voice, do you ask for permission or do you ask for forgiveness? And that's what happened that day. But overall, no arrests, no violence. Everything was great. We left that event and escorted the Ferguson activists around our city. You know, we shut it down for another 3, 4, 5 hours after the march. Mm. So I literally stood up and marched 8+ hours that day, and it was just exhilarating. Wow. Loved it.
Excellent. Yeah, I definitely saw a lot of that online, and I obviously was following everything on Twitter as well, because the actions here that we participated in were a little later in the day in Philadelphia. And it was definitely interesting, and I think what you said is perfect way of putting it, which is conflicting ideologies. And I also thought it was great that they did, you know, kind of take the mic over, because that's, in my opinion, it's kind of the way the movement is. It's not a ask permission kind of movement, because, mm-hmm. and I think it's something that I have conversations on Twitter a lot with people where they'll say, well, you can't do something, or that something won't work. And I'll say, well, you don't know if that will work. That I don't even like the concept of that. People have a hard time understanding, like, this is something new. This is something that hasn't happened previously. Why don't you stop trying to put it in a box, stop trying to define what it needs to look like, and let it do what it's going to do, and let's see what happens. I just feel like, you know, on after August 9th, nobody would have said that anything would have been still going on today. So
right.
I feel like everything that has happened thus far has flown in the face of what everyone's expectations have been. And I also think it's interesting that this idea of it being a leaderless movement, which is ridiculous because it's so far from that. And in fact, I think it's the exact opposite. I like to call it leaderful, because I feel like it's nothing but creating leaders everywhere. And if you want to do something, the mantra has been in the movement, do it. That's mm-hmm. it. That's the main thing that I always say to people when they ask, oh, what can I do? Well, if you think of something to do, go ahead and do it. If you do it, people will come and they'll go to it. They'll support it. And so I think that that's kind of speaks to them jumping on the stage and just doing it, because that's kind of how things have been going. Ivy,
to be fair, I do want to correct one thing.
Yeah.
So a lot of people think they stormed the stage. And right. What I'm talking about is a group called Think More, which is a local D.C. group, and the Ferguson activists, Netta, to be specific. They didn't storm the stage. They actually had passes.
They just took the mic. Right.
Right.
They were like, you have passes, but you're not going to say anything, which is kind of crazy. But yeah. So, Ivy, what was going on where you were?
So we met at a outdoor mall and had we shut down the roundabout at the mall.
Mm-hmm.
And it was beautiful. It was really intense.
Mm.
There were a lot of I live in New Mexico, so there were quite a few Native people, and the people at the mall were mainly white. It was heavy.
Mm.
You know, the emotions were really heavy. But it was beautiful, and it happened. And I think here in New Mexico, we have a 2% black population in Albuquerque, in the largest city. So there's been a lot of, conversation about the difference between all lives matter and black lives matter and how to get that message of black lives matter and why it's important. I think what Ebony was talking about with the conflicting ideologies, we're all learning. Right? Like,
mm-hmm.
we're all figuring out how this is going to work. And it's okay to make mistakes, but the time is now and the place is here. You know? Don't be afraid to mess up. Just, listen and learn from the mistakes, but keep moving. Keep going.
Keep going. Absolutely. Definitely. Here in Philly, we actually went to, there were quite a few events that went here, but the one that we did was at City Hall here, which is in the direct center of downtown Philadelphia. And being holiday season, there's a big Christmas tree in the middle of the City Hall, which takes up a full block, and there's an ice skating rink and like a winter village. And so it's a lot of, holiday traffic and things like that. So this was actually organized by students at University of Pennsylvania, one student in particular. And so he had an idea of doing something I hadn't done. All the other things I had participated in previously were, we had shut down streets, we'd gone on the highway, we had, did a die-in at the 30th Street Station. And so this was something very different. It was a silent march, and he had made up postcards with names of a lot of individuals that have been lost in the last year due to police violence, and their stories on the back of them. And we kind of silently did several rotations around the City Hall area, attempting to hand out the postcards to the people that were there, but in complete silence. And it was a very kind of different space that it put us into. And then we ended it with a die-in around the Christmas tree, which people were not too happy about, because, they come in there and they're trying to get their picture with the tree and all this stuff. And there was all of us kind of around it. So that's what was going on here in Philly. There also was a youth event later in the day, and something earlier as well at one of the Unitarian churches. So lots of stuff going on locally here also. Okay, awesome. So I wanted to just do one bit of news, which I don't know if you guys heard about, but that Congress decided to quote unquote get serious about tracking police shootings. They reauthorized legislation this week that requires states to report the number of people killed during an arrest or while in police custody. This was sponsored by Democratic Congressman Representative Bobby Scott from Virginia. He's one of the sponsors. And he says, you can't begin to improve the situation unless you know what the situation is. We will now have the data. Now, this bill was actually originally the Death in Custody Reporting Act was originally passed in 2000, but it expired in 2006. And Scott has been trying to reauthorize it unsuccessfully four times since then. So it's kind of nuts. Ricky, did you hear about this at all?
I did. And I thought about it a lot. This is the thing, and I'm not trying to be negative about this because it is a good thing that it's happening, but it's basically just giving us a clear picture of what we already know.
Yep.
And that's what there's no secret, just based on the data that we have thus far, that black males are killed disproportionately as a part of police shootings, and police have killed by and far more people than police have been killed. And so there is a problem, and we see it, and I'm glad that we see it enough to maybe take a closer look at it. But we know what the problem is. We know what the problem is in general. We may need to look at the specifics to get policy solutions, but is there anyone who questions, you know, the fact that, you know, literally a white person being killed by the cops is a one in a million thing, literally a one in a million thing, whereas black people are 21 times more likely than that.
Right. I saw a few things that I thought were problematic. One was that even when it was passed in 2000, they didn't start actually getting data until 2004. So All of that time went by after it was passed and no data was actually being passed through at all. So they only had 2 years of quote unquote information coming. And even when it came through, it wasn't good data. The second thing is that it requires them to give information about people that are injured or who die while detained, under arrest, or incarcerated. And I can, off the top of my head, all of these huge cases that have just recently come out, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Akai Gurley, none of those people would fall under this category. So they wouldn't even be included in what has to be reported here. They were not under arrest. They were not detained. And they were not incarcerated. So to me, it's like even the data they're going to get is not even going to hit these people that we find most egregious, because they didn't even deserve to be even in the realm of interacting with the police in any sort of deadly confrontation. What they're talking about counting is people that are quote unquote supposed to be interacting with the police in a confrontation because they're detained, arrested, incarcerated. We're talking about people that are unarmed and doing nothing. So, and they're not even counting them. So to me, it's kind of like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's good that that was able to pass, because since the guy has been trying for the last, you know, whatever years to do it, I guess that's a good thing. But it seems kind of crazy to me. It took him 5 tries to get it passed, and this is where we are with it. But
Yeah, and I mean, the numbers also, I mean, they help, but they're not going to solve the problem.
No.
If you look at, say, the state of Missouri has had basically about 14, 15 years of data based on how often black people are disproportionately stopped in neighborhoods in all parts of the state. It hasn't changed anything. They've had the data for 14, 15 years now. You have to do something with the data after you collect it,
right?
And that's going to be our test, because we're really good at collecting data.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the torture report. We're really good at picking up and collecting data. We're not very good at acting on it thereafter.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Exactly.
Good point.
I think this just doesn't go far enough. I mean, I commend the senator's efforts, but this is not permanent legislation.
Nope.
You know, it's much like the Voting Rights Act. This is important stuff, right? That is not even important enough to Congress to make permanent binding, you know, legislation.
Mm-hmm.
There's no teeth to it.
Nope.
So once we get the data, first of all, it's self-reporting,
mm-hmm.
right? We're depending on the organizations who are committing these egregious acts to actually report this data. If they don't, then what? When they do, then what?
Mm-hmm.
And is that what that's not being addressed? So we have an organization called Killed by Cops. It's twitter.com, Killed by Cops. And they collect that data of individuals who have been murdered by cops. And this is more than just black bodies. We're talking about everyone killed by cops in the country. So we have that data set, and we're pulling statistics from that data set. And that's how we get to the every 28 hours, is because of that crowdsourced data. So while I commend the congressman and Congress for passing this bill, the bill just doesn't go far enough.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I wanted to touch a little bit on upcoming actions. I know one of the big things on the horizon is MLK Day, the week leading up to MLK Day. And I know that CAPV has a huge effort, the 4 Mile March initiative. So if you wouldn't mind just talking a little bit about that and kind of what's been going into that. I know you guys have like 16 or 17 cities already so far that are participating, including Philly. So, yeah, what's going on with that, Ebony?
So the coalition, and this is so exciting for us, the coalition is working with local organizations to create local events on MLK Day. And we started with the 4 Mile March, which sort of created all different variations of actions. So some cities may do a march, and some cities may do die-ins. I've heard so many creative actions at the local level. But the point is to create that day of action to reclaim the dream. So we heard about the dream, and then, you know, at present, we're still having dead bodies. We're still having deprecation of voting rights. You know, we're still having these issues. We haven't realized the dream. So on that day, on a national level, the coalition, in conjunction with local organizations, will reclaim the dream. And the website for that event is 4MileMarch.org.
Excellent.
4MileMarch.org.
Great.
So if nothing is going on in your local city, please sign up, you know, be included, and let's make some action happen.
For sure. And we will have that link in the show notes on the website as well. So I know that kind of this larger goal of reclaiming MLK, I know there's been also some talk about extending it to beyond just the day of MLK Day itself. And tell me what you guys think about this. This is some stuff that's been thrown around, which is building the movement through this weekend and kind of reclaiming not just the dream, but reclaiming the day, reclaiming the weekend, and starting with the Thursday, which is actually Dr. King's actual birthday, with a remembrance of him and vigils for people that have been lost. Then Friday would be a day of training, which would be movement building day, which would, there would be teach-ins, train the trainers and things like that throughout the nation, which would be looking to build organization leadership and teach people how to go about doing this work. Saturday would be a boycott buy-in, where we would encourage people to buy from local Black-owned businesses only for that Saturday. Sunday, we'd be doing a day of healing, which would focus on faith communities and really take a day of reflection and healing of the spirit and lifting our spirits, and then really going into a day of action, as Ebony mentioned, through marches, through actions, and taking stepping away from what I think previous years, or at least in my lifetime, this has been built as a day of service, and moving this from service into action, which is a completely different way of seeing it. What do you guys think about any of those concepts, and especially about moving from service to action on the actual day, MLK Day?
I love it. Yes, I love it. I mean, what better way to celebrate MLK than to take it from service to action. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what he was about. He was about civil disobedience. So let's do it.
Yes, absolutely. And Ricky,
yeah, and I think,
go ahead.
And I think that, I mean, it kind of rings true to his character. And I'm not a particularly religious person anymore, but there's always been one thing that stuck with me, and that's that faith without works is pointless. Mm. And so this is a way of putting the works behind the faith, mm-hmm. and behind service. So I applaud it.
Absolutely. So I'm hopeful that I think that Ferguson Action is going to be rolling out kind of this idea of making it into more than just the one day, and really using this as an opportunity to build as well. So they'll be talking about that day of healing and the boycott buy-in and the day of training. And providing a lot of tools for organizations to do that, which is something that I think has just been what you've seen. You know, CAPV is another great example of an organization that has sprung up to support people. It's not an entity of itself just to support itself. It's meant to bolster other people to do their work. And that's something that I have never seen in movements prior to this one. It just doesn't it's never happened before. It's so unique, mm-hmm. and it's such a supportive environment to do the work in. It's just really inspiring, and I love it. It's just, it's amazing. So another thing that happened was, I don't know, you guys may not have heard, but I have this running joke about something that I call the celebrity blackume, which is that celebrities never come out and talk about anything, especially when it comes to race relations or anything that affects black people, black celebrities in particular. They tend to stay pretty silent and stay on message of sell, buy my stuff, and that's about it. So this week we had a pretty big celebrity come out of the black vacuum. One Sam Jackson. I'm going to play this little video that he put out this week.
All you celebrities out there who poured ice water on your head, here's a chance to do something else. I challenge all of you to sing the We Ain't Gonna Stop Till People Are Free song. Here we go. I can hear my neighbor crying. I can't breathe. Now I'm in the struggle. And I can't leave, calling out the violence of the racist police. We ain't gonna stop till people are free. We ain't gonna stop till people are free. Come on, sing it out.
So that was interesting. What did you guys think when you saw that? I was pretty shocked to see it, actually.
Yeah. I love it. Move people, particularly, you know, these very wealthy people who make money from these soldiers, move them out of their comfort zone. Mm. You know, they're very safe in their display of, you know, support, wear a T-shirt or, you know, do a die-in or show up in front of the cameras at a march. Make them uncomfortable. Make everyone choose a side. Are you for, you know, basic human rights for all or not. Mm. So I think we as consumers need to make, if you have bought a record this year, if you have purchased something that made someone else rich, make each and every one of those people stand up and say, are you for or against this?
Mm.
And that's another big thing that CAFD is doing, is presenting people with, like, teaching people about how we can use our money to make a change, how to boycott, how to support black businesses.
Absolutely. What were your thoughts, Ricky, when you had you seen it before? I'm assuming you had.
No.
No, but, really?
Yeah. This is one of the things that I've come to realize, and that's in order to solve the problem of white supremacy and racism, and that's the underlying problem with the Mike Brown and Eric Garner,
sure.
Tamir Rice, that is the underlying problem.
Yeah.
In order to stop that, you have to call out the moderate to allow it.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. the people on the other side who are vehemently supportive of white supremacy, whether they articulate it publicly or not, they're not going to change their minds. It benefits them. It's the people mm-hmm. who are neutral who service the problem. And many of our many black celebrities, I love the concept of a black human, by the way. But, I mean, many of our black celebrities, they find themselves elevated from what we consider blackness and the trials that blackness usually subjects you to. So you don't have to deal with it. You really don't have to deal with being stopped by the police as often. Because if they see you in a nicer car, odds are that – or if they see you in a really nice car, odds are that they know that you have the money to sue too.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that it is imperative to call upon them to say something.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Silence is violence. You know, if you're silent and passive about this, what's happening, to me, you're a part of the problem.
Definitely. So go ahead, Ivy.
Oh, I was just going to say that I feel like these really creative call-outs are like preventative medicine, whereas some of the things that we're seeing are kind of Band-Aids.
Mm.
And so we can throw out the Band-Aids and just, you know, try to amplify those the things that are preventative medicine.
Absolutely. So I did throw up on, I've been kind of putting it out there, just did this yesterday, which is a Reclaim the Dream Challenge, which is kind of taking Mr. Jackson's challenge and throwing it out to the regular people. A lot of regular people have already answered his call, and there's a lot of recordings on YouTube you can find of people doing this song. And so we're asking people as we head into this holiday week, we're in the midst of Hanukkah, and obviously Christmas is coming up next week, if people will be together with their families, for them to record their family singing the song and tagging it with hashtag RTD challenge. And we'll start sharing that on the FergusonResponse.org website, and I'll have that link at the end of the show as well. We have a short version, and we actually added some additional lyrics. The original song was written, obviously, for Eric Garner by some musicians in New York, and the original lyrics is, I can hear my brother, not I can hear my neighbor. So we did some lyrics that start with, I can hear my brother, I can hear my sister, I can hear my baby, and I can hear my neighbor. There's four verses. That's pretty cool. And we have a bunch of versions as well. Drew Hill did a version. I saw Jesse J, which was the version that I played at the beginning of the show. She's a singer from the UK. She did a version with Luke James, who's an American singer. So I think it'll be interesting and a good way for people to get involved. That's not in your face action, but collectively would make a good holiday activity for you and your family, and also a good way to talk about this with your children as well. So hopefully more people will do that, and we'll see lots of videos coming out of the holiday week. So the next segment, I want to talk a little bit about resources, which is a big reason for me starting the Ferguson Response Network at all, was to kind of provide resources and access to resources. And one thing that, as I mentioned earlier, that I've seen is so many organizations and so many collectives come together to provide support for organizers and for protesters. And one that I had the privilege, or I should say lamentably, had the privilege of interacting with was the Up Against the Law Collective, which is a collective of activists, organizers, law students, legal workers, and lawyers. They know the legal system, its values and limits, and how it can be used for and against us. And they basically provide legal resources for any action that's going on. They provide legal and jail support. They facilitate trainings on rights and legal services, and they make sure that the legal community is there for any grassroots activities that are going on. We had an incident here in Philadelphia. We've had two really huge town hall meetings here in Philadelphia. They've been amazing. The first one had over 400 people attend. The second one was last night. We had even more than that. I don't have an exact number. But after the last one, one of the students from University of Pennsylvania that had attended the next morning, she was awoken by a knock on her door from Homeland Security and Philadelphia Police, who decided that they needed to question her based on something that she had written on a Facebook page about the meeting.
Nice.
Up Against the Law was great because we had actually had a training just about two and a half days prior to the meeting. And Laura, who is the student, she attended it, and it talked about exactly what to say, what not to say. She was very well versed and ready and armed and able to handle herself. But it just went to show at how useful these tools can be and to make sure that people know. And this is a nationwide organization, and I'll also have the website up, but it's wp.upagainstthelaw.org. So I just wanted to make sure people knew about that. Have you, Ivy or Ebony, had any legal issues and any of the actions that you've been involved with at all?
I have not, no. So we're very blessed here at the local level in D.C. The cops tend to take a passive, well, maybe passive is not the right word. There's an understanding between the cops and the protesters. And we'll talk about this later in the show. I just wanted to share the policy that the police department has here in D.C. So there's not a lot of engagement. There's not a lot of aggressive behavior on the side of the cops. So we don't have a lot of, you know, batons or riot gear here. It is very, is what I would like to see happen on the national level.
Yeah. Excellent. Ivy, how about you? Has there been a lot of police presence, and how has that been going
for it has. I think that at every action we've had here have been police. And there was even there was a vigil at the Black Student Union on campus that was just a candlelight vigil. And there was even a police car that showed up to that, which, you know, felt really strange. But, you know, our city is under investigation by the Department of Justice. We've had 27 murders in our city since 2010, so in 4 years. So I think that actually the fear of the police here affects protest turnout.
Hmm. Yeah, I can imagine that it does, for sure. Now, Ricky, I know you're not going to actions, but have you heard anything that's been happening there? What's the local news been like with regard to law enforcement interacting with protesters?
Well, I have four letters for you. LAPD. Need I say more?
Yeah, probably not really, no.
Given the fact that it's the LAPD, they've been fairly well behaved.
Mm-hmm.
But it hasn't stopped business as usual.
Sure.
For example, the day after the Eric Garner march in Hollywood, someone was shot like literally a block away from, or not even a block, actually right on the Hollywood Strip.
Mm.
Shot because they had a knife, or it was said that they had a knife, and from the best I can tell from my independent sources, it was a street performer with a plastic knife.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's still business as usual, and it's going to continue to be that way until we start to see significant change. But overall, I mean, there hasn't been much police action that's that people here would find uncommon.
Mm-hmm. So it's been business as usual, but they haven't been as aggressive as they would have been expected to, say, a year ago. Because I feel like that's been something that I will say that I've been to other actions, and I feel like because the authorities realize what a spotlight there is on these actions, that they are tending to be a little more cautious when dealing with them, depending on the action, because I've certainly, you know, had interactions when, you know, we've tried and been successful on many occasions to block off highways and things like that. But it's always the strategy of how you're going to cut off the police. And there's always just a very also antagonistic interaction with them, generally speaking. And when you're right in front of their faces, it's very intense and unfortunate, and definitely not a fun situation to be in, which is weird in general, because I know everyone there is a law-abiding citizen. And this is where I have such a problem when I'm in these actions, because I just feel like looking at them like, what? We're not doing anything. Why are you why are you so angry? What are you so angry about? I just don't even get it. It's so strange. Okay.
You're actually supporting like what our country is.
Exactly.
No, you are patriotic. You're being patriotic.
Right, and here is even more ironic, because we're always like steps away from where the Declaration of Independence was signed. And it's we talk about it constantly. And in fact, our march that we're doing here, we're ending on Independence Mall, where our rallying point's going to be at the end of our march. So it will make for a particularly poignant moment, I think, for us. We're hoping to actually have our speakers speak from the steps of the original president's house here in Philadelphia, so it'll be a good event that day. But going through some other places that you can get some other resources, one is Ferguson Action, FergusonAction.com. They are actually the group that planned the Ferguson October program in October in Ferguson, where they had people come in and they did trainings, and they've been doing such amazing work. They hold weekly phone calls for people in the movement, and are really been doing a lot of work at bringing together a lot of different organizations and leaders from all over the country working and supporting local work that's been going on, and they have lots of resources on their website. I would also lift up the Coalition Against Police Violence, which is www.thecapv.org. And Ebony talked a little bit about them, but I did just want to mention and read off their mission, which is an organization devoted to demilitarizing police departments and ending police abuse through community policing policies, and economic empowerment. We view ourselves as liaisons between law enforcement and our local communities. And they say, we believe that the best in each of us protects all of us. So they have some really great resources there as well, including like chants and ways that you can organize actions. And then the last resource that I would mention is the website that I've just put up, which is FergusonResponse.org. I have some other resources we'll continue to add there. This podcast will be housed there. You can also submit any actions that you have going on that will then be posted on the Tumblr, which is great to get the word out in your local city and area. But I wanted to open the floor a little bit and talk about what resources you guys have seen that are still needed that you think people are in need of out there while they're doing these actions.
Well, I can start with one. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Ivy.
Well, okay. So there's one that's coming up in January. It's a self-care event that's being planned by the Ferguson, some of the Ferguson protesters. Mm-hmm. And I just love it. It's a self-care event for activists there, and it's basically many of them have been commenting amongst themselves about struggling with PTSD, depression, flashbacks of being tear gassed, all of this stuff, and so they're going to have a self-care event.
That's awesome. Ebony, what have you seen out there while you're doing this work and maybe even online that you've been interacting with organizers that they've been looking for or in need of?
Legal advice.
Legal.
There was a teach-in last week, I believe. There was an international law professor who spoke to the group about the international law and how the UN played a role into creating international law, and the next teach-in is going to be with a domestic lawyer. And I can't remember the flavor of law, but he's going to talk about, just on a national level, what are your rights? And I think a lot of protesters need to be armed with that information. What are your rights? You know, you want to know the law so you can decide if you're going to cross that line or not.
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
In DC, it is, there are two different law enforcement agencies, actually many. But one of the two is the local law enforcement, which is the Metropolitan Police Department. Mm-hmm. But we also have the national, like the Secret Service,
right,
and, you know, the Capitol Police. You have all of these different law enforcement agencies.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to educate ourselves on what's legal, depending on where on the block you stand.
Right.
You could be on federal ground,
right,
or you could be on, you know, D.C. ground.
Yeah.
So just an understanding of what is the law.
Yeah, we have that here, too, because the independent small and that whole area is actually considered a national park, so it's federal land, for sure. Ricky, what about online? Have you seen anything, any holes in the needs of people doing this work?
Honestly, I'm kind of surprised no one touched on this, but just funding. The problem is that structurally, liberal causes and this or progressive causes, there isn't very much money behind them traditionally.
True.
You know, there's not much money devoted to change.
Yep.
Usually, the people with the most power want to keep things the way that they are. So normally you'll see a lot more funding from conservative groups, for conservative groups. So they have a better voice. They have better, their marketing strategies are amazing because they have the funds. They have the funds to go do it. And so I think that that's really one of the biggest things that's lacking. And I don't know that that's something that can be fixed right away. But it's one of those things to where it affects everything.
Yeah.
It affects it definitely affects legal help. It affects emotional counseling because you don't have to worry about people volunteering their time. You can actually pay them and have them give back.
Absolutely. So, no, that's huge.
And I'd like to speak to that. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of when the Coalition a couple of weeks ago had an event. ALEC is the organization that's behind just a lot of things I don't agree with.
Yeah.
One being the Stand Your Ground Law.
Horrible people.
They had a convention. Oh yes, they had a convention here in D.C. So we showed up and we made our voices heard, but we couldn't get inside of the hotel.
Mm.
There was a wall of police blocking us from getting inside of the hotel. And that was an interesting moment to me, that an organization like ALEC could afford to have our local resources create a wall of protection, and us, the people, couldn't get in to have that conversation with them about how we feel about, you know, guns and all of these legislations that they support. So it's really all about money and power. How do we in the movement garner more money and more power?
For sure. And, you know, I think part of that is certainly where the piece of the prolonged civil disobedience and making things come to a halt is really important, because we have to make people uncomfortable. It's the only power we have currently, because we don't have the power. We don't have the money. And that will start to tip things in our favor, because once they see it's like, well, we're not going to get to shop. We're not going to get, you know, I went on this diatribe on the Pennyman Doctrine last week, Ricky, where I was like, you know, I don't want to see any balls dropping on New Year's, and I don't want to see anybody getting Valentine's on February 14th. Like, I want it all to stop. I'm done. So the more we can cog the wheels, the better. That's where I am in my, you know, that's just where my head is right now. I think that's great. But the funding piece is great. And I also love that we're talking about it here on the podcast, because hopefully more people will hear about it and they'll start to put their heads together. I have extreme faith, not only in the young people in this movement, but also I feel like these are the places where some people from the Gen X generation that you mentioned, Ricky, that have let the youth down in this arena previously, can bring some of our expertise to the table and help solve some of these issues. Funding being one of them, not necessarily providing funding only, but also providing mechanisms for additional funding to come into the movement. So those of you listening right now that have those expertise and areas, please come step up and do something and help us do this work and help other people that are working in your areas, either locally or contact one of the national organizations that we've mentioned already. They'll all be linked to in the show notes today. One thing that I have been noticing at ACTIONS is that there need to be some resources developed for in action communication. I was at a protest and we were, as I said, tactically trying to get to a specific location the police didn't want us to get to. And a police officer was very close to me, and I heard over his radio very distinctly that this person said, "We need everybody to come." I won't say the exact streets, but basically the gist of the message was, if they get past this point, we won't be able to stop them from getting where they want to go. So I'm sitting there with this great information for our purpose, too far from the front to make this known to those that were leading, and not really a good way to communicate with them. And this is just one example of a situation where I found I've been thinking about potentially that being a way for people to communicate better during actions, something secure, something where information can be transferred between parties that are participating, and you can have people at different points, especially when it's larger groups of people, which is the actions we've been seeing. And it doesn't work just for strategy things, but things like chanting, when you're changing a chant, when you want to have everybody change direction or do something different or split in two or all sorts of things. So that's something else that I've been thinking could be useful as well out there in the streets, so to speak.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that can really be useful is accurate framing, and that comes from media. That comes from media outlets, whether it be myself and Leslie as podcasters, or Elon James White as a podcaster, or some of the more progressive media.
Yep.
There has to be an accurate framing, and so that people understand that what this is really about. That like the fact that we even have to answer, the fact that we have to answer the question of why not all lives when we're talking about Black Lives Matter speaks to a marketing and setting that and framing that so that people understand. Like there are some people who will not get it. They're just antagonists, and they're doing it because they're in power. Yeah. They have all the things working for them, so they have no reason to want to change the system to something more fair. But outside of those people, you have people who would genuinely be behind us with respect to the cause, but they don't understand the framing, because when they look at mass media, they're thinking, "Oh, well, Black Lives Matter. is that just only black people? And it's like, no, it's, you know, there's a specific explanation behind it.
Yeah.
And then that has to be understood before, before it really becomes more popular.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that maybe, I mean, maybe I'm second guessing you're playing armchair quarterback, but like the hashtag Black Lives Matter too would have been a lot more palatable.
Mm.
Because we know white lives matter.
Right.
There's no question. And I think that adding just something as simple as two denotes that right off the top. Is that, yeah, we know that, we already know that your lives matter. We are, that's a given. That's why it's two.
Right. That's interesting, but, Ricky.
Because I'm a firm believer that language matters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it does.
It does. And I do, it is a little bit of armchair quarterbacking. Is that what you said? Is that the right term? I'm not good at sports. I'm not good at sports analogies. Okay. It's not like Monday morning quarterbacking. That's different, right?
They're about the same.
Oh, they're about the same. Okay. Well, either, whichever one it is. Yeah. It's a little bit of that. But I do agree with you that language matters, which is something I talk about all the time as well with a lot of people. I talk about it with Drew all the time, too, about how important language is. But I will say that being in a large action and saying the words Black Lives Matter, it has a specific impact without the two, because I do think that there's this idea of not having to consider anything else when you say it, and it being a final statement. And there's a power in the moment of saying it, you know, and also the looks that you get when you say it to people. Like, honest to goodness, I've been in actions where, like, kind of walking through cars and we're just, that's the chant that's going, and you're kind of looking at people and their cars, and like, I can almost hear them saying the N word. I swear I can like, yeah. I can see it forming in their minds, and I can feel it come right through the glass at me. And so in those moments, I don't think that a two would have helped. Because they don't really, they're not really open to it. But I do see from the message standpoint that certainly, it would be good to have that in the conversation when you are talking about that. Especially when you're trying to break it down for someone who's trying to make the argument that, you know, all lives matter. It's like, okay, well, yeah, Black Lives Matter too. Okay. Then I feel like you could end a lot of conversations with that small little word, actually, Ricky. So
yeah,
I mean, appreciate that addition there. I could blow up a bunch of people
Monday
on Twitter.
It is morning quarterbacking and a bit of armchair quarterbacking, but it's just people forget how powerful words are, and even something like so simple as a single 3-letter word completely changes the discussion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There are times when I wish that we could go back and kind of change white privilege. Like, okay, if this turns off people so much, you know, white privilege, people hear it and they just like shut down. Oh, that's not me. But maybe we need to use the words white privilege for that reason. You know, maybe we really need to talk about what it really is. You know, when I'm talking to people, a lot of times I don't use the words white supremacy. I would say white superiority or systemic racial bias, just because I know people shut down, you know, and I'm talking about white people, you know, they shut down based on that languaging. I don't know.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right about that.
I think that comes from framing.
Yeah.
Because they don't understand what you mean. When we talk about white supremacy, we're talking about the fact that white people, whether you're male or female, Your life is literally valued more than other people's lives. If you look at financial earnings, it's white men, white women, and then everyone else, basically. And so you
and healthcare and education and judicial system, like, it's just across the board. It's everywhere you look.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, and I think that again, it has to do with framing. When you define, when you state those types of things like white supremacy, I try to be more direct, where I'll use the term, but I'll express exactly what I mean by it, because people have so many different definitions of words in their mind that a lot of times they just can't comprehend. You know, you think about how every word has a technical definition, a colloquial definition, people just not knowing how to differentiate between the two.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I knew we wanted to also talk a little bit about dealing with tactics of police and government while we're doing this work. And I know, Ebony, you had a few points to make on that. I talked a little bit already about the situation we had here with Homeland Security. I did want to mention the specific thing that triggered the visit from Homeland Security, which was that Laura, I'm mentioning her name because she did go public, and this is actually in a story, and I'll have the link to it in the show notes as well, that she had put after the meeting that she was in the action group. So they were talking about different things that we were planning on doing, different actions and things like that. And she said that she described targeting the Christmas Village at Love Park, targeting disgraced and retired Philly cop Jonathan Josie, and targeting Commissioner Charles Ramsey in an upcoming protest action. They considered that to be, let me see if I can find the exact notes, they considered that to be threatening because she used the word targeting.
Mm-hmm.
She said they considered it threatening and questioned her regarding plans for violence against the commissioner or other persons. So,
right, but was Homeland Security called on the people who were the Tea Party people who were protesting in front of the White House talking about hanging the president? Anyone? I'm pretty sure that didn't happen.
Yeah,
that would have been called tyranny.
Well, they didn't use targeting though, maybe.
Well, they used hang.
They used more than targeting.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like, you know, apparently targeting was the magic word.
Yeah, targeting's the magic
word. Just said targeting.
They said if only, that would have been everything.
And that's funny because that's actually the word
I use when go ahead.
No, I was going to say, actually targeting was used with the bullseye. I don't know if you remember
when
the Tea Party was at its height.
Yep.
I don't believe it's there anymore. When the half governor of Alaska had these bull-eye targets all over the nation, and they used targeting, and she used all of these loaded phrases. So there was a lot of loaded language used by the Tea Party, but were they visited by Homeland Security? I don't know, but I
doubtful.
The answer is largely no.
Yeah. Exactly. And then I did also see there was an issue that happened in New York where they had used LRAD, the noise weapon, against some protesters, which is a long-range acoustic device, or LRAD. They used it, I guess they acquired it in preparation for the 2004 Republican National Convention, and they used them at some points during the Occupy Wall Street movement. But December 5th, they deployed them against marchers protesting the non-indictment, obviously in response to the non-indictment of the officer who killed Eric Garner. And this is a photojournalist, Shay Horse, who says, "It feels like your eardrums are beating out of your head. It makes the side of your body that you've been hit on feel numb and that your sinuses are inflamed. I felt like I had blood coming out of my orifices. I heard the ringing for about a week." End quote.
It's torture.
According to research by the group, that while 85 decibels can cause hearing loss, the device can hit up to 162 decibels using a high-pitched beeping sound that witnesses claim is unbearable. "We have complaints of really, really intense pain. According to the manufacturer, it's supposed to be so painful that you cannot stand it, so you leave the area. It's caused nausea, pain, dizziness, panic, headache, and lots of complaint of hearing loss. They also failed to give a warning to the crowd before they deployed it in this instance."
Well, can I point something out?
Yeah.
You guys, I don't know if you guys understand where, like, the LRAD was even, where it came from. It was developed after the USS Cole bombing.
Hmm.
And so this is what we're talking about, is literally a tool
warfare.
Of war.
Right, a warfare agent.
This is a tool of war.
Hmm.
And this is why things like the torture report become so interconnected with what we're talking about, is because those techniques are just tools of war.
Yep.
The M16, before it was a household gun that people were waving around and running around with in targets, was a weapon of war.
Yeah.
And so this is something that we always have to be conscious about when we talk about what we're willing to do in the course of warfare. Mm. And because, again, it's just a tool. And then it becomes, well, it's just a tool to get the bad guys. It's just a tool to get the enemies. And then once they're done with it, it's like, oh, well, you know, this tool is really effective at law enforcement. We're still just getting the bad guys to just different places. And so you have this, you literally have a slippery slope, because there's always, the tool always works. It's just whether or not it's morally acceptable to use.
Yeah, and you know, there's right. that quote where they say, you know, the reason why you have a military to fight foreign enemies and a domestic police force to serve and protect, because when your domestic police force becomes the military, then the enemy becomes the populace. It just is. There's nothing else. What are they going to do? They're here. Who else are they going to think is the enemy?
By default.
Which is why the coalition really focuses on that 1033 program. What you're seeing is those tools of war being used domestically and in situations where they don't have to be used. I'm interested in 6 months or a year from now in seeing how these 1033 acquired military gadgets are harming individuals. So you have tear gas. You have tear gas that's illegal on a UN, like, I can't remember the name of the national law. You can't even use that in war, and that was used in Ferguson. How many miscarriages are going to come about? How many breathing problems, asthma, or, you know, all of these problems are going to come about? How many, you know, deaf children are going to come about the use of these 1033 acquired, you know, military weapons?
Yeah, and
we don't have that data yet, but it's going to be a problem.
It is. And Ricky, mm-hmm. when you say the price that we're willing to pay, I remember very succinctly, you know, well before the Darren Wilson and non-indictment decision came about, they had a town hall meeting there with the commission or the city council. And one of the gentlemen got up and he said, are you guys really going to let this entire city burn down for one racist cop? You really are going to do that? And it became so evidently clear that yes, they were willing. Mm-hmm. That was okay with them. And so it always, it comes back to my head quite often whenever I see, like when this LRAT thing came out, when you hear about a safe space, an indoor safe space, a cafe getting tear gas while people were in it in Ferguson, on the regular, when you see what was happening in Berkeley, when you know, all of these things that continue to come up, because they continually are happening. And, you know, I say this, everybody's like, you may not think that your city doesn't have these things because you haven't seen them yet. It just means that they haven't felt like they had to use them yet. And trust me, there will come a point where they'll say, okay, now these people are getting a little bit too out of hand, and now we need to do X, Y, and Z. So, you know, it should be concerning to all of us, because it really can and will happen everywhere if we get to that point in their eyes, for sure.
Yeah, and I've been tear gassed before in boot camp. So I one thing I will say about tear gas is it is a really, really good decongestant. But at what cost?
You know, right.
Like there's certain things that, again, everyone, like John Pennyman says, Leslie, it's okay when you do it, though.
Right.
Because it's always okay when the bad guy is someone else.
Right.
When you suspect that when the government suspects that you're the bad guy, whether mm-hmm. you are or aren't, is irrelevant. But
right.
whether they suspect it, are you okay with those tactics being used on you?
On you, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And I think like the war on black people has been going on for 400 plus years. But now that, you know, it's coming out, we're being able to see it. Everyone, you know, and now that war is going to be on whoever comes up and stands up for black people.
It's true. Yeah. Well, let's flip to, while it might not be a more happy topic, it's certainly a little bit more positive one, which is healing and dealing, which, as I mentioned at the top of the show, was something that has been a huge topic within the movement. And as I mentioned earlier as well, that this is going to be a sustained effort on everyone's part. And part of that is learning how to take care of ourselves and take care of each other within doing this work. So I wanted to mention that on FergusonAction.com, they actually have an activist burnout resource there. There's a short test you can take to kind of see how you're doing if you're concerned. And then it has some really great tips for strategies for sustainable activists, culture care, and also some self-care strategies as well. And they go from some reflective things that you can do. They talk about eating well, getting enough sleep, obviously, which is easier said than done. And then also talking about prioritizing and making sure to spend some time doing things you like, even if it means watching three seasons of Buffy the Vampire Slayer in a row. So I did want to give you a minute to talk about this, Ivy, because I know this is kind of your area, and you created a really great space online with a self-care space for people that are working in this movement to really only have fun stuff to share with each other and have a positive area to go to when we're dealing with this.
Okay. So I do see that the resources are being made available through the movement. I think that a lot of the organizations that you've talked about are starting to provide those for people. And I think one of the biggest things that is good to make clear is that grassroots mental health is just as good as professional mental health services. Mm-hmm. You know, when it comes to the things that we're looking at, like burnout and trauma, helping each other, you know, using simple tools and simple self-care things works. You know, you don't have to go and pay and see a psychologist. You can go on the internet and just Google search self-care or how to, you know, trauma symptoms or that, you know, that kind of thing. You can access tools on the ground and in the community, and we can help each other. So, you know, reaching out to the people who you know and saying, hey, how are you doing? You know, are you okay? Or I see that you're not doing all right, you know?
Absolutely, definitely. Ebony, have you guys done anything locally there in D.C. with regard to self-care? Is that something CAPV has been thinking about at all?
No, we haven't, but I think we should. We actually had a protester who was very active or is very active but ended up in the hospital. And I think it had a lot to do with stress.
Yeah.
Because he was out there every night beating the pavement. Personally, I subscribe to self-care. Even if I don't think I need it, that periodic shut everything off, get some rest, disconnect is what I subscribe to.
Yeah.
So I don't get to a point where I'm getting even close to burnout. You know, we need each and every individual on the street every night if possible. But if I feel like I'm about to break or I feel like I need a break, I take it. And regarding breaks, you know, even when I'm home taking that time away, social media is there, right?
Right.
So,
social media,
you know, with
is
all
there.
Of us who are active on Twitter, for example, you know, we have a lot of people who aren't happy with all of the activism. So there are a lot of trolls, a lot of just negativity there. That's something else I disconnect from. So if that's my source of abuse or source of, you know, negative energy, I disconnect from that also.
Yeah, that's a great point, because definitely it's hard to disconnect from the negativity sometimes. And you can really get into a spiral of kind of obsessive compulsive, you know, interaction there. I know here in Philly, it's funny because there's a coalition of us that have been kind of organizing these town meetings and doing all of this stuff together from a bunch of different organizations. And we were putting the agenda together for the first town hall meeting, and we needed to decide what breakout groups we needed to have. And somebody, one of the people in the group said, well, we need to have a group for healing and dealing. And we were like, really? Some of us were like, yeah, I don't know. Do we need that? And she was like, no, we need it for sure. And lo and behold, we got to the meeting. We had a beginning part where we had a kind of open table. People got to come up and talk for a little bit. And then we announced each of the groups to break up. And the healing group was huge. People were so into it. They really wanted to contribute to it. And it's become a really big core piece to the work that we're doing locally. So I would encourage everyone that's listening, if you're working locally with other organizations, to definitely take that back and hold, lift that up and start to create some avenues for you all to lift up self-care and also come together as a community and take care of each other. And as Ivy mentioned, in Ferguson, they're holding a self-care event in January. I'm going to just read from the website. They said they're... says, hello, everyone. I'm a Ferguson protester. And throughout my months of being on the ground, I've found that my comrades and I, that for my comrades and I, self-care needs that have gone unmet. In response, I'm currently planning a January self-care event for Ferguson protesters. I intend to have therapists / counselors, massage therapists, manicurists, food, and anything else that I can get this community progressing towards healing. After facing off heavily armed police officers and dealing with the frequent hatred directed toward from citizens that don't support the movement, some of us struggle with PTSD, depression, etc. So I'm planning this event to help with us sustaining the health of everyone out here. In order to sustain a movement, you must sustain the people. So that's a great event. I'm hoping that they get lots of support for it locally and nationwide. And I'll talk a little bit in a couple of segments about how you guys can help them achieve that goal. Ricky, what do you think about self-care and kind of this notion of having that big be a big piece of this movement?
I am a huge, huge fan and a huge fan of self-care. I'll be a little upfront. I suffer from depression and anxiety, and I have for most of my adult life. And there may or may not be some PTSD from my time in the military. That's I've never actually looked into that or formally had that diagnosed. But that's the only thing that keeps me going, is to be able to say, fuck this shit. I need to step away. Like, it's as simple as that. Like, it's like I need to go. Otherwise, I won't be here for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Because we have to remind ourselves, this is a long game.
Yep.
This isn't something that's going to happen in our lifetimes. This isn't something that's going to happen. This may not happen in our children or our grandchildren's lifetimes. Mm-hmm. You still need to enjoy your life.
Yep.
You still need to be able to have enough in the tank that when you are out marching for 8 hours, or you're looking at policies that help solve the problem, you have to have some fuel in the tank. It's just that simple.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I'm going to move on to our next segment, which is actually something I'm going to do every week. And actually the healing and dealing segment is going to be one I'm going to do every week as well. So I'll be having different people come on specifically to talk about that area of this work and different techniques and also different tools that people can utilize to support themselves and support others. So you'll be hearing lots more on that topic, and we'll be doing some specific work in that area. The other thing I'll be doing is go ahead.
To add, I mean, that was a huge proponent for the AUA movement to do our AUA Hope podcast, is because much of it is self-care, and much of it is trying to get you to a place where you're able to make the changes that you want to see in the world. Mm-hmm. I always tell Sherelle, who I love very much, love you, honey bunny, that the goal with our two shows is that with the AUA podcast, I get you fighting mad, and she gives you the fuel to do something about it with, mm-hmm. and still take care of yourself.
Yeah. I love AUA Hope. Your podcasts, but just saying, I was the last one in particular, I was just like, oh my gosh, hearing from the doctor. I've been talking about it for weeks. So definitely. Everybody make sure you check it out. So the other spot, I'm going to be doing an organization spotlight every week as well, just kind of lifting up different local organizations that are doing some work. And this week I wanted to talk a little bit about the New York Justice League, who played a huge role in bringing between 50 and 60,000 people to New York this Saturday for the Day of Resistance for the Millions March there. You can find them on Twitter at New York Justice League, and you can also find them at the gatheringforjustice.org website. And I'll just go through kind of real quick what they are all about, which is Justice League New York City is a task force of social and criminal justice advocates, activists, and formerly incarcerated individuals brought together in early 2014 by Carmen Perez and the Gathering for Justice to develop Growing Up Lockdown. This initiative will continue to work together in pursuit of viable, implementable juvenile justice reforms for New York City and state. I don't know if you guys knew that they actually held a, they demanded to see the mayor in New York City. They had 10 demands that kind of came out of the Eric Garner decision. I'll go through them really quickly, which is the immediate firing of Officer Daniel Pantaleo. The state of New York will appoint a special prosecutor. The city and state of New York draft legislation making the chokehold illegal. New York City create an NYPD training program to eliminate racial disparity and police brutality. An immediate end to NYPD's broken windows policing. An end to the criminalization of young people in the New York City school system. They have some specific points under that one. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder expedite the federal investigation into the death of Eric Garner. Immediate passage of the Right to Know Act. State and all local localities engage in complete transparency in regards to profiling, and they called on the mayor, the governor, and the New York Attorney General to meet with the Justice League. So they had put these demands out immediately after the decision came down, and they got no response. So the mayor was having a party at his house, at Gracie Mansion, and they decided to turn it into a protest. So they did a mansion shutdown on the 15th and called for people to just come there, and come there they did, and shut it down they did. And so they actually got their meeting with the mayor, which I believe is taking place tomorrow. They'll be discussing each of these demands with him directly. And so awesome. I just wanted to lift them up for just, you know, A, having such specific demands that they're, that they've clearly thought through, and the effect that they're going to have on the city and the work that they want done there. And then two, you know, having a way to get to those actions being taken. So, again, that's the New York Justice League. And I'll talk a little bit about them, too, when we go through some gifts. So the holidays are coming up. People looking to give gifts to people. So I thought I'd go through a couple ways that you can give some gifts to the movement, because you can do that nowadays. So obviously, you know, people donate stuff all the time, right? I mean, you can give a cow to somebody now, I think. That's like a thing you can do, right? Don't they do that now? I don't, maybe that's just a white thing. I don't know. We can give like cows to people like in foreign countries
or
something.
An actual cow?
Yeah.
An actual cow.
Yeah, an actual cow. It's like a whole thing that that white people do. I don't know.
Not a stuffed cow.
No, no.
Not a plush cow.
Nope.
Not a cow blanket.
No.
An actual cow.
Yeah, it's like the heifer something another. I don't know all the details for it. Anyways, we're not advocating for that. We're advocating for something completely different, which is giving back to the movement. So one of the ways that you can do that is lots of people have wish lists on Amazon, and I'm going to have a link to a couple of these on the show notes. One is the Justice League NYC. They have a wish list for things that they use their actions for. So external battery chargers, bullhorns, megaphones, walkie-talkies, battery chargers, umbrellas, batteries, lots and lots of batteries, and markers, all sorts of stuff. So you can get things for as little as $7 and go all the way up to $100. They also have like granola bars, things like that, that they use when they're doing all of their actions. And then also the self-care event that's happening in Ferguson, they also have a wish list, and they have things like different candles, yoga mats, bath salts, aromatherapy items that they're going to be using at the event and for people to take home afterwards as well. So you can go on to that link as well, to their registry, and help them out and sign up there. They also have a way for you to give back to them. You can just donate via PayPal. I'll have that link on there. You can support the protesters directly through PayPal. I'll have a link up for the supporting of both Netta and DeRay. And then one that I think is a really great one, which is the Missourians Organizing for Reform and Empowerment More. They have a bail donation fund donation, mm-hmm. so you can donate directly to them. According to the organizers, the police are aiming to deplete the bail fund that they have set up. So they've been making bail for any arrested protester $1,000, which is the legal limit, because they hope to get rid of all the money that they've collected. So that's a really great way to give back and continue to support the protesters. Now, that's if your person that you're giving the gift to is happy just getting a card saying this was donated in your name. But maybe you have somebody that needs something to open, which I totally get. My sisters are like that. So if you have those kind of people to give stuff to, I have two great gifts for you. One is the Ann Counting shirts, and you guys may have seen them out. It starts with Emmett and Amadou and Sean and Oscar and kind of keeps going from there. They have a new one as well that has Eleanor and Tarika and Rakia and Renisha and Yvette and .. So you can buy, this is on glossrags.com. I'll actually have a link as well for you to take a look at that. And then the other one is the Unapologetically Black t-shirts, which you can buy. They have a Teespring that's going on right now. They're going to be available until a couple of days from now, I think, actually. And I'll have that link available. And that goes to BYP 100 is the organization, Black Youth Project 100, activist-based organization of Black 18 to 35-year-olds, dedicating to creating justice and freedom for all Black people. They do this through building a collective focus on transformative leadership development, nonviolent direct action, organizing, advocacy, and education. So those two things are great to give back to people as well. I think
I have something I would like to add.
Sure.
Support your local activists.
Yes.
Walk up to them and give them a thank you card. Give them a hug. You know, drop off supplies at the protest site if you're not able to be there physically. Really, really support your local activists. I know we have the national level activists or activists who have national notoriety, but there are a lot of boots on the ground, and there are a lot of individual activists who just want someone to say, you know, thank you. You know, you're out here and you're trying to make the world a better place. Honk your horn, you know, raise your fist, give them their support.
That's a great thing to mention, Ebony. Maybe we can put together a list of ways people can do that locally. I actually remember, and this is going to sound weird, but during the first Obama campaign, I had done like some phone canvassing and stuff, but we were wanting to volunteer at our local office, campaign office, and we went to go volunteer, and there were so many people there. They couldn't use all of us. So we just went and bought food for everybody. We got like pizzas and sodas, and we just brought and we fed everyone. And it wasn't a big effort on our part, but it was what they needed at that moment, and it really did help them. So that put me in mind of that when you say support, that, you know, you never know what little bit of support can go a long way. Even if it's just dropping off like, you know, six coffees or a box of donuts or whatever it might be to people that are out there, you know, in the cold, or hopefully it won't be too cold for too much longer, but yeah, doing all that hard work. So I want to just go around, let everyone get some last thoughts out before we finish up here. Why don't we start with you, Ricky?
Last thoughts. Well, first off, again, thank you for having me on the inaugural episode. I really, really appreciate it. My last thoughts are that this is a long game, and this is something that we have to remember, that this isn't going to be done next week. And so we shouldn't be acting in a way as if we expect it to be done next week.
Absolutely. Ivy, how about you?
I would just say that there's no right or wrong way to respond to this stuff emotionally or mentally. the trauma symptoms sometimes feel like that, oh, there's something wrong with me. So if you're having numbness or a pounding heart, anxiety, mood swings, dizziness, nightmares, all of that stuff, sometimes people feel guilty or ashamed. That's all normal. You know, you're having a normal reaction to an abnormal event. You know, being tear gassed is not a normal thing. So reach out to somebody, ask for help, start taking care of yourself. You know, listen into this podcast and find out more ways to take care of yourself, but stay connected. I think that one of the most dangerous things is to become isolated.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Ebony, how about you?
So this is the movement. This is definitely a marathon. So, you know, do something, contribute. Nothing is too small or too big. Do what you can to bring about justice in the world. Black Lives Matter.
Okay. Excellent. And I just thank all three of you for being here and spending this time going through these topics. I look forward to, I'm sure I'll have you each on in the coming weeks. My plan is to do this at least once a week and continue this conversation and just provide additional outlets for people that want to come on. And if you're interested, just hit me up on Twitter at Leslie Mack, and you can find the podcast on FergusonResponse.org. It will be up on Stitcher and iTunes shortly, as soon as this one's done and up on the feed. But initially, you can just find us on FergusonResponse.org. And I guess I'll just leave with Asada Shakur's words, which are said in Ferguson whenever they go out to do any activity, which is, it is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love each other and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains. Thanks and good night.